speaker is Dr. Paul Demers. He is the director of the Occupational Cancer Research Center in Toronto. He is a senior scientist with Cancer Care Ontario and a professor at the Dalla Lana School of Public Health at the University of Toronto.
Okay, thank you. Let's see here. Okay. What I'm going to talk about over the next little bit is just what the impact of asbestos has been on Canada health-wise, and that's what we're calling the burden of asbestos-related disease. So I'm going to give a bit of an overview of that, and I think touch on a number of other issues. I think at least if people are, in the last few decades, there's been a lot of focus in on asbestos as if it is a Quebec issue. It certainly is a national issue across Canada. These are just some clippings from the mid-70s for the most part, from various parts of Canada. At that time, as you'll see, there was asbestos mining in a number of different provinces, a lot of asbestos industries still going on. But certainly this is a very long-standing issue across the country. Well, I was actually, you know, whenever you have a group of people presenting on the same topic, there's always the danger of having the same slide. So I have to say, this is one of the slides that actually at least comes from something that I'm partially responsible for. This is from CAREX Canada, which is a project funded by the Canadian Partnership Against Cancer to try to estimate the burden of, or not the burden, but the prevalence of exposure to various carcinogens across Canada. And in the course of doing this project, we did try to pull together a lot of historic information about the different carcinogens that we were examining. And this is one that we did for asbestos. And I think it's an interesting, there's a few interesting things here, and I'll try not to repeat what's already been said. But you do notice here that there were a number of other provinces at one point. Certainly it's always been a very big industry here in Quebec and just till a few years ago. But if you added up all of these things, I think you'd see that there's quite a bit of production for about a 20-year period in many of the other provinces, and that only really ended in the 1990s, which from the scale of when we knew about health effects is still a very late time for both the asbestos mines in Newfoundland and British Columbia to have closed. What people don't realize sometimes also is that we still import asbestos products into Canada. I don't have this updated till the very latest years, but we continue to import cement products, friction materials, very little in the way of raw fibers, but other types of things that are still used in Canada. And we certainly, I think there are members of the public who think that asbestos is actually not used at all in Canada, which is really not true. We still do use it in various ways. This is a table that I think also I don't need to spend a lot of time on because Jim gave a very detailed idea, I think, to everybody about how asbestos is used, particularly in construction. But this is a table put together by the Health, Safety, and Environment Department of the University of British Columbia, which is my other academic affiliation is at the University of British Columbia. And it says when some of these uses kind of began and when they were discontinued, if they were discontinued, and which ones still go on. Maybe this is a little bit out of date, but I think it's actually pretty good. The important thing here is the friability of these things, and you see at least we're going in the right direction for low friable things are more in the recent area. But despite the fact that the dates of use are there, many of these products still continue to exist in a lot of our buildings really across the country. This is another slide from the CAREX project, and what it lists here is just the numbers of some of the estimates of numbers of people who encounter asbestos on a somewhat regular basis. Certainly there are many people who will occasionally encounter asbestos in various areas of construction. And we know that this is certainly an underestimate for total asbestos exposure, but it gives you an idea of what types of industry sectors. And our estimate was that 150,000 still come into contact with asbestos on a semi-regular basis. It doesn't include some groups that we know do come into asbestos contact that might be difficult to estimate, and that would include groups like school janitors that were being discussed earlier. Certainly there is asbestos that has been used in schools or contaminated vermiculite from Libby, Montana that has been used in schools, so it certainly is a major concern amongst unions that represent janitors in schools that those cases exist, and there have been cases compensated among school janitors across the country for those reasons. And this is just again the same kind of stuff, just spread by across the country, and you can see that certainly always the biggest numbers will be in Ontario because it is the largest province in terms of population, but probably a somewhat disproportionately high number we're estimating for Quebec and BC and Alberta because of the types of industries that are there, things like petrochemical, pulp and paper where it's still used, and many other industries. This is a map that we put together, which I think has a number of interesting features to it. The areas here that are in yellow were at one point mines, some of them very minor mines, like these down here. These are where the bigger mines in Ontario once were. This is the big mine in British Columbia, although there were some smaller. This is the big one in here, but you see that in fact there are potential deposits of asbestos in a number of different areas of the country. Naturally occurring asbestos is an issue in the United States, more so than here. And these former mines are certainly a special issue in and of themselves. One of the issues in naturally occurring asbestos is that in California there were actually recreational areas that had asbestos kind of outcroppings in those areas. And if you ride something like a recreational vehicle through there, you can actually throw up a lot of dust into the air. And I thought that was, a challenge for the places like California. And then a few weeks ago, I was in Newfoundland at their former asbestos mine, and I saw people riding the tailing piles of the asbestos mine in their recreational vehicles. And the area is actually very, very poorly secured in terms of that. Has not been remediated very much. They've removed the mill itself, but there still is a lot of asbestos floating around that area. It wasn't the most efficient process. There's a lot of asbestos in those tailing piles. So it remains a fairly active area, I think, environmentally. I also have on here our vermiculite processing facilities. These are actually the vermiculite processing facilities where Libby, Montana vermiculite was processed in Canada. We got a list of all those facilities from the U.S. government agency, from somebody in the National Institute for Environmental Health Sciences, and hundreds of thousands of tons of vermiculite came into various places across Canada and then were used in insulation. That practice stopped in about the 90s, early 90s, I believe, but still there is a lot of that asbestos-containing vermiculite that is out there and around. I think for those of us who have not been near an asbestos mine, it's sometimes surprising how close they can actually be be to the towns themselves, and here you see asbestos. I mean, this is a little bit of drama that's probably closer than it really is in the way that the angle is here. But in fact, some of our asbestos-containing facilities are really quite close to populated areas. And we know, particularly from studies that have been done in a number of these areas, that these do represent a fairly serious environmental risk. Certainly high risks of things like mesothelioma, which Dr. Coleman was talking about, can occur at relatively low levels of asbestos exposure, have been increased around these kind of facilities. And this has been seen in Canada. It's been seen in a number of other countries around the world. So as part of the CARE-X project, we tried to kind of estimate how many people live within 5 kilometers, and it's not a huge number. Within 10 kilometers, it's somewhat bigger, but you get the idea that there are people who still live relatively close to a number of these former mines. And I've placed it here also so that you can see that it's, although the largest number is here in Quebec, you do get them in the other provinces as well. A difference in places like Newfoundland and British Columbia is that those mines are very, very isolated. In Newfoundland, the traditional town where the miners lived or the towns where the miners lived are actually relatively close but relatively depopulated as the mining industry there has gradually withdrawn. In British Columbia, a lot of these folks are actually members of First Nations communities because the actual town is totally abandoned where the Cassiar mine was. In terms of potential to be near naturally occurring asbestos, and this is not necessarily to say that there is asbestos there floating around always right now. Things have to disturb. You have to be disturbed. In some cases, it won't actually be that available. We haven't investigated as much, I think, here in Canada as they have in the United States, as it's become a larger issue for the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. But this gives you some idea of numbers of people that might be near those areas. I'm actually going to do something, which is, this always looks funny, but I don't have a watch, so I need to kind of like keep track of my time, and I don't see Eduardo with like little signs with numbers to put up there to tell me when to stop, but I will try to periodically check in to make sure I'm not talking too long. The Libby vermiculite has been mentioned on a few different occasions, and I think it warrants a little bit of mention because it is pretty widespread here in Canada. This is a picture from the Minneapolis Star Tribune from the year 2000, and this is a group of workers that worked in one of these popping facilities that was mentioned a little bit earlier, that the vermiculite is actually popped or heated, and a lot of the fibers go into the air at this point. I also kind of lament the fact that this is not the very big screen. You can see the names of these workers and then what they've been diagnosed for and whether they had died as of the year 2000. And as a person who does studies of the impact of workplace carcinogens, this is an amazingly terrible impact. You don't see, half or maybe a little bit less than half of workers developing asbestos-related disease very often. Lots of cases of asbestosis, lung cancer, mesothelioma. Even back then, a number of these folks had died. So this contaminated vermiculite was a very, very serious thing, even though on paper it doesn't look like there's a huge amount of tremolite in the vermiculite. The problem is what we call asbestos and what we don't call asbestos. And the term asbestos is actually a commercial term, more than mineralogically. It's a group of substances that were commercially useful that have a similar set of properties that were there. And this is, I won't go into this. I'm not sure I could go into this. I might have to seek the help from one of our previous speakers. But in fact, what is called the Libby amphibole is only about 5% tremolite, and the rest of it is winchite and richterite, which aren't classified as asbestos, but these are asbestiform fibers that probably share a lot of the similar health impacts that you would see for tremolite. So this raises a very big regulatory concern for not just the United States, where it actually is being looked at by the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, where there is concern about, well, we can't really call these other things asbestos. They're not listed as a substance that we have to regulate. There's a lot of it there, and their concern is that the health impact is more related to this entire mix of different fibers than just that tremolite contamination. So this is, I think, a concern also for things like fibrous zeolite, or which is a similar type of mineral that actually is listed as a carcinogen. And that's been used in some of the gravel at the sides of roads in North Dakota, which also was mentioned earlier. These are new challenges, I think, of other types of fibers that we have to remain fairly vigilant about. I'm going to switch now to talking more about disease, and I've put this slide up just to kind of as a bit of a transition. I found this a very interesting table. This is from the U.S. Institutes of Medicine's, which is part of the National Academy of Sciences, from their report on other types of cancer that are related to asbestos. I was actually part of this panel. I can tell you this was not your group of radicals that were putting this together. It was actually a fairly staid group of people. And what I think I find interesting and what I like to point out to people is just how early some of the health impacts were suspected, when we were pretty sure about them, and when they were well established. Now, the purpose of that particular panel was to look at other types of cancers other than lung cancer and mesothelioma. But certainly for things like lung cancer and mesothelioma, and especially for asbestosis, very, very strong evidence very, very early. And if you remember the slide that I showed about when we were opening new asbestos mines in provinces across Canada, that was just after this period here in the 1950s and really ending in the 1990s. So really kind of spanning a period where we knew a lot of the health impacts of asbestos. These are mesothelioma incidence rates and numbers of new cases from 2007 from the Canadian Cancer Registry, which is the registry that kind of collects data from all the provinces across Canada. It allows us to look at some comparative rates across at least the larger population provinces for both men and women, and to look at numbers of cases. So nationally in Canada right now, we're up at over 500 cases of mesothelioma a year, at least as how we're classifying it with our tumor registries across the country. That number was still growing as of 2007 when I put this slide together, and I'll show you a little bit on time trends for these in the past. You see here that there's a little bit of variability across Canada. Certainly we see a higher in Quebec, particularly for men, but also higher among women as well. And there are people that have estimated at this point in industrialized countries, there's some French investigators, I think Marcel Goldberg and Daniel Luce have said that they think that maybe up to 20% in some countries of mesotheliomas may actually be environmental now rather than occupational, which is a pretty concerning thing. And it's part of our kind of, when you think about how much asbestos has been put in various buildings, how much remains in our environment, how much of that vermiculite-containing insulation is still in the rafters of a number of older homes, it certainly is very concerning that that's the case. But overall about four times as many cases, or over four times as many cases among men than among women, which is probably related to a lot of the occupational exposures that we've had over time. But it's interesting that certainly Quebec is higher, which makes sense, as was mentioned earlier, in terms of the industries that have been here. In the United States, if you look at asbestos-related diseases, the highest rates are often seen, in fact, in places where there's also shipbuilding. Back historically in British Columbia, there were probably, I believe, up to 50,000 people working in the shipyards before they started closing down in the post-war period. And that may explain why British Columbia is actually quite high as well. But I'll give you some examples of other uses of asbestos in British Columbia that may be responsible for those higher rates. Now, this is just tracking over a period of time the kind of increase in the number of cases. It's been slowly increasing in women, if you were to look at the trend, and that's continued. And in men as well, the number of cases has continued to rise over time. This just goes through 2005. These aren't rates. It would look a little bit less dramatic if you adjusted it, because the population of Canada has continued to rise as well. But it does give you an idea that this problem is growing. Another thing to, I think about is the kind of where the impact is happening. And this map is just from the province of Ontario, and it shows mesothelioma rates by a public health unit across there. Now, I'll point out that mesothelioma is rare enough that in order to kind of actually show this for all the different public health units, we had to kind of look at this over a broad period of time. It gives you an idea of where some of these higher areas are. The lowest, like you can see here, that this is statistically low and statistically high. Certainly this is where Toronto is, if people are wondering and not sure of the geography here. This is the area around, this is Lambton County near Sarnia. Sarnia has a very, very bad legacy of asbestos use. There was a notorious place there called the Holmes Foundry, where a lot of insulation was produced. A whole lot of people developed asbestos-related disease as a result of that. In addition, this is the kind of one of the centers of the petrochemical industry in Canada, is here in Sarnia. Sarnia's known historically for the blob, if anybody remembers it, the huge chemical spill that happened in the river there. But in fact, a lot of asbestos was used in the petrochemical industry, as was mentioned earlier. So that the rates here are much higher than anywhere else in the province. But there are other areas where it was also high that we don't have as good of an explanation for, but it gives you an idea that the impact of asbestos-related disease is not evenly sprinkled across the population. In fact, it varies a lot by different regions, and really does reflect both probably employment patterns and environmental exposures as well. I put this in here for comparative purposes, and I have to say that this is a bit back of the envelope, but I wanted to have Canada on the table, and I didn't, so I did this as a back of the envelope, and it might be a little bit off. But it gives you the idea that in Australia and the UK, they were actually higher, Italy quite high. We're a bit higher than the United States in terms of our mesothelioma rates. A similar ratio as places like Australia, maybe not so different than the U.S. and some other places. I'm not sure exactly what happens in Italy to lead to this closer ratio among Italian men and women. What's also here is the predicted peak of when we think mesothelioma is going to drop. Now, what people have been doing in recent years is trying to statistically model, because we know how much asbestos has been used, when in fact there will be a drop in the cases of disease and for what we are calling the asbestos epidemic. And you can see that this varies. The U.S., there are people in the U.S. who believe that that it may have already peaked in the U.S. I'll leave that to Leslie because there's not a 100% agreement with that, I think, as well. But it's an interesting thing that it would have gone there, whereas we're not really sure here in terms of when that's happened. Not that we haven't tried to model this, just like everybody else. I have draft across here, but I mean, we're really going to be going back and looking at how we actually did this in order to, because we don't think this is necessarily accurate. One of the things that's been observed in looking at international rates of mesothelioma is that we're not going to see the dramatic drop in mesothelioma that we saw in terms of the rise of mesothelioma. That, in fact, because exposure to asbestos both deals with the initial exposure because of producing products, mining, and things like that, and then the continued exposure from asbestos-related products and building materials, that asbestos is going to persist for quite a bit longer, and even in places like Sweden, it looks more like a plateau than a real drop, but at least we hope that it will plateau at some time. You see this little weird blip here that we've modeled in. This is the move to the International Classification of Disease, the 10th revision, when there was then a specific, more specific coding for mesothelioma. And at least in Ontario, we actually saw what appears to be an increase there, at least when we model it. It looks like it jumps around here, but through the magic of statistical modeling, we can see patterns where not everyone else can. But we certainly see that there. But you also see that we don't see necessarily, we had a low year that I think may have helped this model, but in fact it still continues to jump around at this level, and we're not necessarily seeing at this point the drop that we had we would have hoped for in mesothelioma here. This is a table that I just pulled out for convenience, and what it shows is in red here is asbestosis, and what you see is a gradual rise in asbestosis at the same time that we're seeing decreases in things like silicosis and other types of pneumoconioses and things like that. Most of those are actually dropping. This is a phenomenon that we're seeing in the United States as well and in some other countries where asbestosis continues to rise slowly we're seeing it dropping for the other types of dust-related diseases. And what I should explain, since I'm not sure the background of everybody else here, is that the pneumoconioses are a series of really dust-related diseases. These are almost all caused from exposure to various types of dust, either that's silica or coal dust or other types of inhalation of dust. So it's interesting to see this pattern. But what you saw before were hospitalizations, and that's what's easy to get kind of national or statistics on. But it's important to recognize that there's probably a lot of asbestos out there that we're not really capturing. Asbestosis is a disease that certainly, once you have applied the label, you've assumed causality. One would think that that would all be compensated. Some of these cases that we're seeing in our medical services data, this is actually, I should step back a bit. This is from a study we were doing in British Columbia, trying to look at asbestosis and whether we could assess the full number of cases of asbestosis. And what we tried to look at is if you identified cases of asbestosis from compensation data. So these are the 312 cases that were compensated over this 25-year period. Is that 25 years? Or is that 15 years. So 312 cases from there. There were 533 that we found in hospitalization data. So a larger number, but usually if it's mentioned on a hospital discharge record, at least in theory, it is supposed to be not something that is totally asymptomatic. It usually should be something that impacts the patient enough to get mentioned on there. And then this is in the medical services data where we see a lot more people identified where there were at least two times over the course of a few years that they were getting a diagnosis of asbestosis. So we tried to make it several times because it certainly should be in there multiple. Presumably what you get is initially some suspicion and then a patient receives a chest x-ray or some other kind of thing that would more definitively put them in there. So we're not sure if all of these are cases or whether they're symptomatic, but it gives you an idea that there's a lot of asbestosis that is still out there. And depending upon how you measure it, you'll get a very, very different number of cases. So we tried to look at trends within British Columbia where we had access to those three sources of data that we had linked. And we see the same pattern that you saw nationally, that gradually the rates are increasing among men. These are much higher rates than you saw with hospitalization alone. And certainly they're increasing over time. And we saw the same with women, but it jumps a lot around with women because there are many, many fewer cases. But at least when we plot a line through, it looks as though the same thing is happening with women. In terms of cancer, although we spend a lot of time talking about mesothelioma and the number of cases of mesothelioma, part of that is convenience because we can count mesotheliomas. It's a distinct disease. It's a disease where the great majority of cases are believed to be associated with asbestos. So we even assume, in fact, that all of them are due to asbestos. But in fact, the single largest hitter in terms of cancers from asbestos, at least based upon study of asbestos workers, is going to be lung cancer. And so the group that I was with in British Columbia, we tried to go through some exercises here to try to estimate just how many cases of asbestos-related lung cancer there were out there. Using a variety of different methods. And what initiated the study was trying to convince the compensation board to adopt a broader policy of compensating work-related occupational cases of asbestos lung cancers. What we tried to look at, and I'll describe the different things here slowly, is we tried to look at many of the studies of asbestos workers, of which there have been many, many different studies of people in mining and shipbuilding and cement plants and textile plants and other different types of groups. And we tried to look at the ratio of how many excess lung cancers did they see there for every mesothelioma. You see a wide range in the studies, and we actually came up, this is actually the median number, and this is the arithmetic mean number, which we decided to use as our range for this. This is equivalent to 5 to 8% of all lung cancers. If you were to translate this using the current number of mesotheliomas we have here in Canada, and then apply those kind of ratios. And it translates into 1,300 to 2,100 lung cancers per year in Canada. We also went and looked at case control studies, and there are a number of different case control studies over time that have tried to look at how many lung cancers are due to a variety of different agents. And what we did in those is we tried to use the attributable risks from those, so the proportion that those studies would predict of all lung cancers, and this is a range of studies conducted across the world, mostly European and North American, And we arrive at a fairly similar number of about 1,600 to 2,100 lung cancers. This is a project, and I should acknowledge some of the other folks here, Chris McLeod, Kim McLeod, Leslie, who will be presenting next, and Mika Kuhorn. So we actually had a fairly good thing there. Oh, I'm being given the 5 minutes, so that's no problem. Okay. But at least this gives you an idea. I think earlier on I said that the mesothelioma rates were higher in British Columbia, or similar to Quebec, as compared to the other provinces where they appear lower. This is the Cassiar asbestos mine in British Columbia, northern British Columbia, no longer exists, but it's probably contributing to that. This is actually a worker spraying asbestos on a BC ferry, when BC ferries were still built in British Columbia. But also, this is part of the legacy of shipbuilding in British Columbia, where a lot of asbestos was used. And I can tell you, this type of a respirator looks better than it actually works. You know, we're not sure of the risks associated with a lot of the other things, such as brake lining, but certainly these are areas of concern. But this is, and I'm sorry for the tiny picture I'll make of the same lament as our first speaker, that I thought of, you know, big room, big screen. But this is a rail car with a bunch of bags, and they're actually preparing cement for some of our mountain highways in British Columbia. What you can't see here is the JM on the bags. So this cloud is asbestos. These are people simply taking a knife, cutting the bag, dumping it in a hopper. Enormous exposure during the 1950s and into the 60s in the building of highways. This is just to say that, you know, in using this ratio method, you know, if people are wondering whether this is a bit, you know, of a funky method to use, there was a recent paper by researchers affiliated with IARC and some others who produced kind of this range of different ratios. And remember, ours was about 2.8 to 4.5, depending upon what types of asbestos are being used. And so they separated theirs out. If you combined all of theirs together in the average of all their studies, it actually comes up pretty close to where ours would be. But I'll point out this, that for chrysotile asbestos, which is thought to be have a different ratio of lung cancers to mesotheliomas, that is, to be perhaps less potent when it comes to causing mesotheliomas, that means that there's more lung cancers have been observed for every case of mesothelioma in studies of workers exposed just to chrysotile. And so you could see that that ratio would be much higher, and if you applied that to Canadian standards, it would be you get a lot more cases. I just thought I would mention very quickly a few other things here. These are trends for compensation for asbestos-related disease in Canada from 1997 to 2010. You could see an increase of less from maybe 80 per year in 1997. Now we're compensating well over 200. If you look at asbestos-related lung cancers, it's not keeping a pace, but worse than that, the ratio is about a half a lung cancer for every case of mesothelioma. So, in fact, we're really way undercompensating as lung cancer as opposed to mesothelioma. So using compensation statistics to get an idea for cancers other than mesothelioma is really not good. But actually, if you look at it, we're up to compensating about a little over 200, and if you remember, there's a little over 500 mesotheliomas. Current feeling is, I don't know, people present different percentages, and it depends upon how many you think are environmental, but probably the average is about 80% that people think. 80% of mesotheliomas are work-related. This is about 40%. So we're only, even for something that is very, very clearly associated with asbestos, we're probably compensating only about half of the cases. I'm not going to talk a lot about the other sites of cancer, but there is evidence. This is the U.S. Institute of Medicine review. This is the most recent IARC review. I was on this. Both Leslie and I were on this. There were certainly split votes when it came to things like stomach cancer. Larynx cancer was agreed upon by both groups. Interestingly enough, ovarian cancer was added by at the latest IARC meeting, which is probably one of the more controversial things that happened at that series of meetings. But it gives you an idea that there are a number of other cancers out there that we could begin trying to estimate. I'll tell you that when we've gone through models in terms of ratios from different studies, still lung cancer is way and above the single biggest hitter. Part of that is because a lot of the excesses we see of these digestive cancers are in studies with where the exposure to asbestos was very high. This is the correlation between lung cancer risk and stomach cancer risk that we see going across. But basically, these ones that see an excess risk of stomach cancer were amongst really high exposed groups. Recently, some students of Leslie's actually did a paper looking at ovarian cancer and kind of re-reviewing it after the IARC meeting and kind of verifying the fact that the patterns that we observed at IARC were, I think, in fact, valid, that we see a 77% increase in the studies that where women were exposed as a meta-analysis, the risk of ovarian cancer among women exposed. And this is my last substantive thing. I'm getting the... See, yeah. Eduardo doesn't even need a sign. He just needs hand signals. But he's placed very well for this. Anyway, I thought I would end with this and just say that in trying to think of the impact that asbestos has had on Canada, we know that there are 500 mesotheliomas a year. There's a lot of assumptions made here, but I put a pretty wide range here of 1,300 to several thousand lung cancers per year, additional cancers of the larynx, ovary, pharynx, stomach, and colon, depending upon where you stand on work relatedness for those. But overall, I think it's a pretty safe bet that several thousand people a year are diagnosed with asbestos-related cancer, and the great majority of those are from mesothelioma and lung cancer, which are going to be fatal cancers. So this is an enormous impact. And with that, I'm going to end, and I'll acknowledge my sponsors for my center here, the Cancer Care Ontario, the Workers' Compensation System of Ontario, the Canadian Cancer Society, and the Steelworkers. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Demers. So are there any questions? Yes, can you come to the microphone, please, and introduce yourself?
Hi, my name is Moshe Nuddin, and I'm just a public attendee. I just want to know, what is the current risk for current environmental risk for general population? And you said 2,000 new cancers are being diagnosed each year. So, how can one prevent this from affecting them? And what are the environmental risks for the general public, not the occupational, but from where we can get this cancer risks?
It's a difficult thing to quantify. I'm looking here from other speakers, if anybody wants to jump up and answer this one. It's a difficult thing to quantify. In fact, there are lots of potential ways that people may be exposed. I think that in the previous talk about asbestos in buildings, it certainly is important to be very careful to keep to remove the asbestos safely from our buildings and things like that. I'll I'll say that probably the general risk from in urban centers is not huge, except if you're in a building that where there is a lot of asbestos-containing materials. At least that would be my opinion. But there is, probably a risk in the communities that are near the asbestos facilities and in some other situations. But it is a difficult thing to quantify. It certainly is something that we want to take every effort to be very careful whenever we're handling it. And you could see how expensive of a prospect that is in terms of our second speaker of today.
The buildings that were built with cement, do you think those living in those buildings would have high risk?
Not if it remains in the cement, but those buildings eventually coming down, I think, is going to be an issue. I think we had, some sign of that, and there's a lot of concern with that, with the World Trade Center coming down. But I worry more about the more friable uses that you saw in one of those earlier slides. And these slides are going to be available for people to look at after the talk. Is that right? Yes.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
I'd like to ask a question, Paul. Thank you very much. Great lecture. Now, very, very interesting that the numbers of compensation, the case of compensation that you related, why is lung cancer so much lower? Is this because it's as clear-cut as a case would be for mesothelioma?
Yeah, it's with mesothelioma, whenever I give lectures to medical students, we always say, one of the problems with occupational disease is that a disease looks, the same under the microscope, and there are only a few exceptions. And I say, well, anybody have an exception? The mesothelioma and asbestosis are those exceptions in terms of teaching people about the importance of taking a history. And knowing what your patient has been exposed to. So some of this is the lack of recognition that people may have, and certainly their physicians may have, of historic asbestos exposure that the patient may have. Part of it is the problems in the compensation system with the fact that if someone is a smoker, the bar is much, much higher, despite the fact that has been mentioned that there's a synergistic relationship between smoking and lung cancer, and that shouldn't be the case for denying a claim, but yet, in fact, it often is. Compensation policies are quite different across the country. I think probably Ontario compensates the most lung cancers. There's some places like Newfoundland and some of the other provinces, I think even Alberta, that compensate very few lung cancers. Almost because of the synergistic effects, almost all of these asbestos-related lung cancers are going to be people who have smoked at one time in their life, just because that combined risk really pushes you through the roof for getting this. I don't know if that's helpful as an answer.
Thank you.
I just make a comment. For compensation, under-recognition is a huge problem, but another observation is that to be eligible for compensation, you have to have paid into the system. You have to have been covered. So compensation data can never cover the population at large, people who are self-employed, people whose asbestos exposure antedated their work in Canada, mm-hmm. Things like this. So that there will always be an under-reporting in that respect.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, in most provinces, provinces vary from between 70% and 90% of the working population being covered by the compensation system. So we would hope, I think, better than half getting covered. But it's true that some will fall through. It's also true that I'm not including the military's compensation system, and I know that they compensate mesotheliomas every year. So there will be some gaps for other insurance things, or people who were exposed to asbestos while working in asbestos industry in another country. Those are also, when we've looked at that and tried to identify those cases, they're relatively small numbers of cases, but they're worth the mention.
In terms of stringency of legislation, litigation process, how are we related to the U.S., for instance?
I let one of our U.S. speakers answer that, but I think we're relatively similarly challenged in Canada to the U.S. There are more people in the U.S. who will actually use lawyers and go outside of the compensation system to sue the manufacturer of an asbestos if it's as a third-party suit, if I understand it right. But I think I would let others, if anybody else wants to answer, who knows that. Barry?
I'd like to comment on that. I'm Barry Castleman. In the United States, we have something called product liability, and that means that if you sell a product that has non-obvious lethal dangers, like asbestos products did, and you don't put warnings on the product, and if someone gets harmed by the product, that person can sue you, and you have to pay full damages to that person for their medical costs, their lost earnings, their pain and suffering. And this goes in front of a jury. Cases of this kind, mesothelioma cases, commonly settle for several million dollars for an individual, and jury awards may be $10 million or more for an individual in these kinds of cases. And it's because of the litigation that we have very thorough histories taken of these people, because the lawyers from all the independent companies that are defendants all want to blame someone else or spread the liability around to other defendants. And so very thorough efforts are made to go through the history of the individual, every job he ever had, every kind of exposure to asbestos that the person may have ever had, whether occupational or non-occupational. But this does account for a great deal more compensation to individuals in the United States, even after the lawyers take their cut. And so I just thought I would mention that. That product liability, I should point out, is a great public health protective thing that we have. And I think the Europeans, and I hope Canadians, will also take note of the fact that the lack of liability for putting warnings on lethal products like these asbestos products is an invitation to toxic corporate crime. And in order to protect the public health, to have these kinds of legal protections in place is enormously important. The drug companies could care less about the Food and Drug Administration, but when they start getting these reports of side effects from new drugs and other kinds of failures, they know that the longer they sit on that, the worse it's going to look when these cases start coming in and juries start seeing what their reaction was. And that's what compels them to make disclosures to the government, not the government regulatory authority, but the threat of product liability.
Thanks for that. I actually have never seen a percentage, though, of cases that receive some form of compensation, either through legal means or through the compensation system for the states. I'm going to guess in places like France, we also see about the same rates of compensation as we see here. That is, less than half, or maybe a bit more than half in some countries.
Thank you.